Just a quick review. We talked about Job last time. And the point of that was to get us familiar with what Jung means by the transformation of God, and then what that means for us if we're going to participate in that process, and therefore what Pali did not want to deal with. We then looked at the dream of Peter Strom, page 88, and we took that as a reaction to Pali's recalcitrance in understanding this business of the transformation of God, therefore the transformation of the self, because we're seeing them as analogies. And the I think the real salient image was the wind. The wind, we know from the Bible, is the breath of God. Ruach Yahweh is the breath of God, and the Spirit that comes where it listeth is the Holy Spirit. So it's directly connected up with the, how should we put it, the direction of the will of God, you might say. So putting it something like that. Which means that God is entering into the human process, and the way he's taking it is that implies a dialectic. So that the presence of the wind implies the possibility of a dialectic. And just the opposite of what Pali is saying, that there is no such thing as a dialogue with God. That takes us over to 90. Now, Peter Strom was the new professor chosen out of this storm. And Peter, we talked about, as rock, Strom as flow or stream. The necessity of a rock solid commitment and the necessity of being flexible and flowing. It appears then in the next dream on page 90. And I generally think Arthur does a pretty good job, but I kind of came at this dream a little different than him, and it seemed to me he missed some obvious things. So let's look at what he says and how we might examine it. Walking in nature, in a forested landscape, in normal daylight, in front of me I catch sight of an unoccupied house in a valley. Then I hear the voice of a commander, certainly to be identified with Peter Strom, behind me, call out in military tones, "Occupy the station." I take the station to mean the house, and moreover I see that several people are following me, some unknown, some young Jewish students. Among these people, there is a young, dark man, lanky, lean, with light Jewish features. To my feeling, he has shadow qualities, but this is not to imply anything simply negative. The order of the commander seems very reasonable to me, and I easily carried out with the others. As we are below, his voice, must be the voice of the commander. Sounds again, it's typo, whatever it is. Seize the goods. I see various foodstuffs laid out in the house in a very matter-of-fact way, like a delicatessen meat sausages. I immediately collect them all. Now the young man, that's the man with the Jewish features, comes up to me, appears very satisfied, but says to me, "I absolutely need 300 Swiss francs from you now." I pull these out of my pocket and give them to him, as I don't want to put myself in a bad position with him. I even quite like him. So, Peter Strom is back now. The new professor. And he's asking this group of people to occupy a station. And he's accompanied by a fellow with Jewish features. And just to get the main, just to get the main idea out of the way, which we'll get to, is meat. He doesn't mention anything, which to me would be common sense.
What meat might symbolize?
Yeah.
Like meaning or something?
Uh-uh.
Reality?
Uh-uh. A piece of meat.
A necessity.
We're not going where I think we're going.
Yes, we are going where. Yeah, I think it's about sex.
Baby? Okay.
No, just about sex. About you know, his the opportunity of von Franz's meat, flesh, being there.
I thought the same thing with 200 Swiss francs. That's phallic. The francs are phallic, aren't they? Isn't he talking about...
No,
oh, that's money.
Money.
Oh, I was thinking meat.
You're worse than I am.
Right.
But 300 would definitely be, you know.
Too much.
But if we think about his behavior, he was fond of going to prostitutes and paying for sex, right? Wasn't he?
Yes,
family?
Yes. I think he probably was. We don't know for sure, but I think he probably was. That's a possibility. I hadn't thought of that. But I think the fact that it's Peter Strom that's orchestrating this would kind of speak against that. So he's... I took it that he's... And I didn't feel the author stressed it enough. That it's coming back to his relationship with von Franz. It's showing him that here is the way to the new professorship through your physical attraction to her.
Gary, can I ask, is there such a thing as a Swiss franc?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's what the currency is called, Swiss franc. There's a French franc and a Swiss franc. Did I spell it right? It's F-R-A-N-C.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, I spelled it wrong. That's probably part of it. Should be C-S. Okay. Now, he also says it's difficult to interpret these Jewish elements. And yet, on page, you needn't turn back if you just want to mark it for yourself. On page 84, he quotes Pauli as saying that his Jewish background at the very bottom is related to, or the Jewish psychology heritage is related to, the capacity to inquire into murky depths. So I'm kind of surprised he missed that. But that's how I would take this, that the meat would be the sexual reference, and the Jew would be the ability to delve into the murky meaning in that physiological attraction. Now, the author also mentions something which I think is, I just don't get it, but you know, I think he's making something out of nothing, which Pauli refers to, but he picks up on it, is this business of the opposition between Catholic and Protestant. We'll see that dotted throughout the next couple of pages. I'm not sure what to make of it. Basically, I think Protestant to him means linear. and Catholic to him means nonlinear, or imagistic, or mysterious, and Protestant means clear. But I just don't see why that suddenly becomes such a big deal. Pauli converted from Judaism to Catholicism, and then back to Judaism. Protestantism was never an issue for him, so... To me, it's just one of Pauli's... Pauli will refer to it. I think it's just one of his intellectual isms.
How was he raised? Was he raised in a Christian home?
Well, yes. Well, his dad was Jewish, but abjured his Judaism. And so the home was Catholic. And he didn't even know his dad was Jewish until he was in college. But his mom was Catholic. But I think, you know, in custom only, they were not avid followers. But, you know, probably culturally Catholic, if not religiously Catholic.
What's this sentence? There's a word left out. I guess it's page 91. We're not there yet.
Oh, go ahead.
Okay. In that second paragraph, this third sentence, the house thus means and is yet unrealized attitude reality.
Oh, yes, I have a question mark there.
Is it acting toward
it must
reality?
Be toward reality. I'll have to check that.
Okay.
Yeah. So he takes it on 91 as developing Pally's taste. Take your pick.
You almost run him into the same thing.
Yeah, but it seemed to me he missed the body reference.
He's talking about his sensation and feeling function. So I guess you could elaborate on his idea and hook up with your idea.
You could, yes. And the other thing I think that is really important, no matter how we take it, if we read Pauli's letter to von Franz there after the first paragraph, I can give another amplification to my last dream, namely in reference to the empty house and the military commandos. In a later dream, they were empty combat trenches, and that means that Russians fought there earlier, but they had cleared out of this area and left it behind. That is surely a consequence of that storm, the previous dream, and seems to me a positive indication. So the Russians there would represent the fascistic attitude of not allowing his individual needs and voice and feeling, nor those of others, to surface.
So the Russians were his what attitude?
Well, repressive, fascistic. In, you know, fascism does not allow the individual a voice. And we've seen how Pauli did not really allow these women a voice. That's the Russian in him. And it will also not allow him to really undertake what the new professorship is asking, because it will clamp down and squash any individual expression.
Not only that, though, and maybe I just don't know history, but Russia was an ally, and then went into communism.
Yeah.
So is this when?
Well, see, this is during the Cold War.
Okay,
yeah.
I already picked up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And I think they knew even during the war that Russia was a fascistic state. I mean, there was that conversation between Roosevelt and I think it was between Roosevelt and Stalin, and Roosevelt said, "Well, we've got some minesweepers we can let you have," and Stalin said, "Well, that's what we have ground troops for." Hmm. See, that's fascism, and that is just the attitude that does not value the individual life, the individual voice.
Would that be like Yahweh? Would that be like a Yahweh?
I think it would be. Yeah. Certainly one dimension. So, as he says, the Russian stands for Pauli's own tendency to repress everything in favor of the collective. And it has been cleared out. That's the good news. But as we'll see, it becomes a flip-flop back and forth between an almost and a not yet. And then he does say, we're going to see, you know, and this is the way this work works, that an insight does start to trickle up, but then it drops down. And that is not uncommon, and it surfaces and it drops away. It surfaces and it drops away, and what one hopes is that it eventually surfaces and stays. But here, in his case, it's not going to stay. So we're going to watch partial reactions to the truth, and this is one of them. Now, for me, the whole key to the situation lies in the female figure. With the head alone, I have nothing more to say. So there he gets it. But, you know, we'll again see him in a minute turning this down. Well, the next last paragraph on 91 is Pally's regressing back to the old point of view immediately. I can best describe it in the simplest possible words, the soul poison. The human speaks to God, "I forgive you, Lord, because you do not know what you're doing." There is no model for this in the West, though this feeling attitude seems to come closer to the Eastern spirit. They take love from God, but they give him innocence. And humans, as the whole world, seem to awaken in new trust and openness. So that's absolutely nuts.
I don't understand what he's saying.
Well, it's all wrong. That's the first problem. The human speaks to God, "I forgive you, Lord, because you don't know what you're doing." Now, that is Pally's answer to Job. That God doesn't know what he's doing, so we should forgive him.
And how's that tying to Schopenhauer? He's connecting that to Schopenhauer.
Yes, Pally's extrapolation of Schopenhauer. Where Job said, "I hold you responsible, Lord, because you don't know what you're doing." See the difference? Now again, apply that to himself. He's saying, "I forgive myself because I don't know what I'm doing," versus, "I hold myself responsible for not knowing what I'm doing." Great difference. So he's fudging and playing with Jung's answer to Job and Christianity, and he's coming in between somewhere. He grants that we can speak back to God, but denies that we have to hold God responsible, which again means that we have to hold ourselves responsible. There's no model for this in the West, though this feeling attitude seems to come closer to the Eastern spirit. Well, that may be. They take love from God, but they give him innocence. Again, I think that's partly true, but Buddhism doesn't recognize God. So, he's not quite right. But it is true, I think, they do look at life through an innocence. And as the whole world seemed to awaken in a new trust and openness. So what he's saying is that in a way they're better because they are not suspicious and they're open. But that's just flat out naivete. How can you be open to a world in which there's evil? Particularly if you remember what started his inquiry was Hiroshima and Nagasaki. What good was trust then? See what I mean? He just skirts around these problems. So he's back. You know, for a minute he starts to grasp, and then he's back. The poisonous fang of human-like consciousness is extracted from the cosmos, and it can no longer, like the human, be made morally responsible. That's saying the same thing again, right? That makes sense. That God can't be held responsible. That's what he means by the cosmos.
Oh, okay.
An unconscious knowledge or a multiple knowledge may be present, but no human-like consciousness. I believe this is also the feeling attitude lying at the base of Schopenhauer's philosophy. I think that's the basic.
Is that true?
I don't know enough about Schopenhauer to tell you. I could imagine it's true, yes, that, but I just don't know. I'm not sure that Schopenhauer sees, this might be it, that Schopenhauer sees what he calls the will, the blind will. I'm not even sure what that is. Let's call that the energy of life. Isn't conscious, but human beings are, and what human beings have to do is reflect the nature of that energy so they understand it. I think that's where he's coming from, Schopenhauer, but I'm not for sure. In any case, that I don't think in Schopenhauer that blind will is capable of consciousness. But we have to then do what it can. I think that's the difference, but I'm not sure. Right. I don't know if you're interested in this. If you're not, stop me. But what they are doing, they're kind of arguing about an age-old problem in theology, that how can God be both omnipotent and omniscient at the same time? If God is all-knowing and all-powerful, how can it be that there's evil in the world? People will say, well, he's given us free choice. But if he is omniscient, he knew what we did with that free choice. And as I've heard somebody said, it's like giving a baby an AK-47 and saying, oops, look, he's killing everyone. Well, what did you expect, Yahweh, if you are omniscient? So Jung's position is God is omnipotent, but now he starts playing a little bit, and there is omniscience in him, but he forgets to consult it. I think it's a bit sarcastic, but that's how Jung plays with the idea. And so what we do when we stand up to God in our Job experience is get God to begin to consult his omniscience. Wisdom is his omniscience. Sophia is his omniscience. And Pauli is saying, there is no possibility of God's knowing. That's his solution to the problem. So, I mean, it's an age-old theology thing. And we're not concerned so much about theology, but what it means psychologically. That if we take these statements as statements of ourselves, then, you know, Pauli's excusing himself responsibility. And we've seen how he does that again and again. He hurts people's feelings, and it just doesn't bother him. And he acts like Yahweh, doing hurtful things, and then he can't understand why people don't praise him.
So he
won't
know it when he lays these social bombs, if you will. You think he doesn't know it?
I don't know.
That's
hard to
believe. Is that smart?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's what we call EQ today. Very low EQ. And, you know, do they know? I mean, that's the question. I certainly have had to work on my feeling. And I can go back to college and think of things I did, you know, where it's easier to see with time. And I think, God, how did I not see that? How did I not know how that would have affected somebody? But that's unconsciousness. You just don't. So I'm thinking he probably just didn't. Or in that state, just didn't. See, the thing he says, too, is... it may be a multiple knowledge. which means you have different compartments. At certain moments, you do care. At certain moments, you don't care. And you never see that there's a contradiction. And that's what's really difficult about people like this, because you, if you're in a relationship to them, and they come out of a caring response to you at one moment, you think, oh, there's a hope here. But it's just one compartment. And the next compartment will always be there, unless something drastic happens. This is what Freudians call the borderline personality, where a narcissist will be a creep all the time, and a borderline flips between quasi-caring statements and then these insensitive reactions. So, you know, what he says is, I think just putting what I said in different words, this is the result of the patriarchal worldview. Second line, page 92. Maybe I'll just read those sentences, because I think they're really, really relevant. Rather than seeking a cure for his soul, he would rather remove the poison fang so that the poison disappears as well as any suffering over it. Without the suffering of the soul, without the psychic wounding, the healing powers can also not manifest, and, you know, neither can empathy. Thus love, which can unite on a higher level what had to be previously separated, is sacrificed to childish innocence. Pauli is not reciprocating Peter Strom's yearning for consciousness. Okay, we'll see more of it. Okay, page 94. On the first page there, page 94, he just pretty much summarizes what we already said. Page 95, he alludes to something. I don't remember whether I talked about it or not last time. Let me just quickly touch on it. Remember the Job paradigm, that the ego reflects back to, let's say, the self, or Yahweh, his injustice. And then there's a shift in the self whereby a Christ-like development is created. But that itself, on one hand, is a solution, on the other hand, is a problem. Solution in that it's a further development of the negative side of the self. But it's a development of the positive side only, and the negative is excluded. And that is, they base that on the, I think it's in Luke, I forget, 3:8, something like that, where Jesus sees Satan fall from heaven.
Pardon?
He sees Satan fall from heaven.
Oh.
So remember, we're interpreting this psychologically, that so that there's a split in the self. And that's where we are today. And what we have to do is bring the light and dark inside ourselves again, and give birth to a new self-image. That's what Jung means by the continual creation. So, split in the self, two sides, that was the Christian eon. Now we are faced with bringing those two together again, and that's another way of saying we are evolving the God image. So that attempts to follow the self and be true to its totality are what Jung means by the further development of the God image now. And another way to say that is it's the continual creation. We start taking responsibility for what we once thought God did, namely, create the world. Now, our creativity is the response from us to this dilemma. But we'll be seeing that throughout this chapter. I don't know if I talked about that last time or not. I don't think I did. So I say that because the first, second line on 95, in the sense of a creatio continua. Some of the things we already heard, just to touch on about halfway down the page, Yahweh is a phenomenon, as Job says, and not a man. Meaning that there's no responsible consciousness. The next quote of Jung's from Answer to Job just mentions what I've said. He never consults his omniscience. 1, 2, 3, 4 lines down on that second quote, as we have seen. Well, this we all talked about last time, so I'm just skimming. Sophia then would be that omniscience. She reinforces the much needed self-reflection. Not 96, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 paragraphs down, Satan has been exiled. Yahweh creates Christ, but he excludes Satan. Which means that the dark God, now that last quote by Jung there, on page 96, the dark God becomes our issue. See where I am?
No.
On page 96, the last indented quote, Bigam Inkar in his turn as the dark God. Again, we talked about this last time, so I'm just skimming.
And that becomes our issue.
That's our issue. To get these two together.
I think it was so complicated I didn't get it.
Get what? Whole thing?
You were saying, yeah.
Starting when?
I mean, the last time. It seemed very
complicated. Oh, it seemed complicated?
Yeah. But I read it over. I mean, my notes over. That's okay. Go ahead. It'll start coming.
Well, let me try a quick summarize.
Okay.
I think the hard thing to grasp here is that Jung is talking on two levels at the same time. The personal self and the image of God.
Okay.
So, when something unjust happens, the point that Jung is trying to make is that we have to register that and not pass it over. Not say, oh, this is really for the good. Oh, whatever happens is meant to be. Now that, in Jung's view, produces a change in the self. And, well, that's just the nature of things. And I guess you could say he's really positing a new process. he really doesn't explain it. That reflections of injustice initiate a process of change in the self. You know, giving you the most a concrete, for instance, take say the race issue in the 50s and 60s. Enough people suffered and reflected back to the nation injustice, and slowly there was a change. That is what Jung is working with as a principle. And it's a basic principle of human nature. I think that's that he doesn't really explain it. He just takes it as a starting point.
He makes a lot of statements about when the perpetrator does the crime, he can't help, he or she can't help but becoming a little bit like the victim. Isn't that right?
If
there's a blending when the murderer murders.
Yes, but I don't think that's the main point here. I think, you know, he doesn't really spell this out, but if I try to, it's about conscience. That there is such a thing as conscience, which operates independent of the ego. And when it sees injustice, it starts to take responsibility for the injustice.
So there's some communication,
contact
with
yourself,
and that's why that.
Right.
Yeah.
Now
I'm really confused.
Okay, because this is something new. I thought it was the ego
that
had to.
Right, but it doesn't really come into reality until the ego tells the self what's going on and participate in it.
Oh, okay. So it's about the conscious God consciousness that's independent of ego consciousness.
Right, but what we're trying to do is hook the two up.
Okay.
And there's a dynamism within the self, but the real key is the confrontation between the ego and the self, with the self holding the mirror up, the ego holding the mirror up to the self and saying, look what you just did.
This look is for the greater good. Your suffering is for the greater good, and I can...
No, just look what you did, how horrible it was.
Yeah.
At the same time.
Right.
And it becomes almost like a dialogue.
Yes.
And then that's when we are full creation.
Right. Right.
In transformation, reading this, Anger talks about it as kind of a compensatory function in the psyche.
Yeah. Okay.
Does that help?
Yep.
So that when the ego becomes too one-sided, or when the self becomes too one-sided, then there's a compensation in the other. Is that what he's?
I guess you could say a type of compensation. Yeah. I think the thing that's hard to envision is how, first of all, how it is that the personal and the collective self merge. And secondly, how it is that the ego can initiate a change in the self. That's where I think it's hard.
Isn't that sort of an unknown as to where that impulse for change comes
right,
from?
Right.
Because, you know, Jung talks about the idea of absolute knowledge.
Right.
And where is that really initiatory factor coming
right.
from?
Right, exactly.
We don't really know.
Right.
We just see the dynamics.
Right. Right.
Did you equate the absolute knowledge with conscience?
Could be. In other words, there is a level of knowledge that is independent of us. Yeah. Maybe it might be more accurate to say, you know, that absolute knowledge and conscience are or partake of the same dimension or something like that.
That our self-image and our ego consciousness are separate from those two entities. Is that what you're saying?
Say that again.
The self-image that we have, the God image,
yeah.
and our personal ego
yeah.
is separate from both of those. Or from absolute knowledge and...
No.
Okay.
Our self-image and... conscience and absolute knowledge are all somehow connected. Our inner self
mm-hmm.
and conscience, well, our inner self is conscience. That's one thing.
Okay.
And absolute knowledge are somehow connected.
And you're spelling inner self with a big S.
Yeah.
Okay. So then, this Yahweh, how's that connected?
He's the unconscious self.
Okay.
He's the self in its low state.
And is he connected to absolute knowledge as well?
Well, only in potential, because he's not in any way moral.
Well, he was with her in the beginning. If Sophia sometimes symbolizes absolute knowledge.
Uh-huh.
He was with her in the beginning, in creation.
Yeah.
So it's as though...
But he wasn't talking to her.
Yeah, if you want to look at it symbolically, he has contact with her off and on.
Mm-hmm.
And is trying to make a more permanent connection.
Right.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So, if Sophia is absolute knowledge, then do we all have a bit of Sophia in us?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So
it's helping or not helping?
It's helping.
Oh, okay.
Who's this amoral
Yahweh
within us?
That's Yahweh.
But he's also in us then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But isn't that also part of the big S self?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
He is an image of the unconscious self.
That has to be seen.
Whose shadow has to be seen by us.
Both personally and collectively.
So we wouldn't say that Yahweh's been transformed and is now working in us in a different way.
No, we'd say just the opposite. For example, you know...
Well, I mean, Christianity altered that symbol,
mm-hmm.
the way it works within us.
But only in word. Not in deed.
So when you say something is for the greater good, that's ignoring your word.
Yeah. I never said for the greater good.
No. I mean, that's what Christianity is.
Yeah. Right. Like, for example, Jung felt that Hiroshima Nagasaki was the dark side of God.
The dark side of self.
Yeah, same. We won't see it. But we are, Jung felt this was the task of the next 500 years. That is just now beginning. I think that's one of the reasons why it's so confusing. You know, just like, as I said last time, just like Judaism transformed to Christianity and Hinduism to Buddhism, we are at a point now where Christianity is going to change into something else. And this is the very first seeds of its shift. Who knows what will be in 200 years. You know, people may look back in this conversation 200 years from now and say they're nuts. They had no idea what they were talking about. Well, right, we don't. But we're trying with these little bits of data we get from individuals going through change to extrapolate into a larger change. Kathy, do you want
to? I've got to get my question.
I think the big thing is the confusion on levels. If you're dealing with somebody who is not a criminal and they've hurt you and they see that and you don't react with a counterattack, they will generally change. That would be a personal example of what I'm talking about, where somebody else's self is attacking you. You reflect back to them their hurtfulness, and they begin to reflect on themselves. That's the simplest level. That's the simplest level up to the most complicated level of war, say. That there you're not talking to an individual, but you really are talking back to God. And just as that individual changed in your reflecting back to them their hurtfulness, Jung is saying the big self will initiate a process of change if you reflect back to it. So it's an analogy.
Was that like Mahatma Gandhi's?
Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Definitely. What he did was he initiated reflection in the English. Mm-hmm. And some people started saying, it's wrong. Mm-hmm. And it changed. Mm-hmm. Now that's on a personal level. And he's also then saying, but there's a, you know, as we know, that the self is a me, but I am in the self. That sort of argument. That what is changing is more than just a personal inner self. Mm-hmm. And the key is the egos. See, if Gandhi had said, well, the British really know what they're doing, nothing would have happened. Mm-hmm. If he had blown them up with bombs, there would have been a war. Mm-hmm. They would not be a free country today. So it's this middle path of registering the evil and reflecting back that Jung is trying to get at.
So instead of practicing terrorism, if you attempted to reach the other people.
That's certainly, I mean, Jung is just laying out one way. But I remember, for example, I remember seeing, you know, when Vietnam War started, before it became real popular to be against the war, monks, remember the monks who would set themselves apart? I'd say, they really don't want us there. That got me thinking, see what I mean? It's different than if we were attacking, we were always thinking, well, they have some ulterior motive. But that's the kind of idea where how the self begins to become more moral.
The part that I just read in here yesterday, he said something about it's in the opposite, when the opposites are there, that God image can be seen and transformed.
Right.
So someone attacks you, and instead of you attacking back, which would be the same,
yeah,
you do the opposite. And in that, then you're reflecting something different.
So
the opposites are there.
Yeah, they have suddenly realized I mean, no, I mean, unless we're talking about criminals, that's different. But when people attack you, they think they're doing it for a good reason. We're in Iraq fighting for democracy. We never say we're in Iraq for oil or for greed or for balance of power. So that's one opposite, the good. And then when you see the other opposite coming, that's the bad, and you put the two together.
Is it that too? We have to see more and more war isn't working.
Once we use that up to the point where it's so disgusting to us, that we're desperate almost to find another way. In a way, I think that's what the Arabs are doing. I mean, I certainly don't approve of their methods, but they're dying too. They're willing to die before they won our strip malls. That, in a way, is a reflection back to us of how despicable our shadow is to them. Whether we agree with it or not, it's if you look at their perception of us, it makes you reflect, if you've got half a brain. And admittedly, people in power don't have half a brain. But I think that's why they're going to be so successful. I think it probably is, yeah. And voluntarily.
Right.
So this is, you know, this is the psychological dynamic that Jung is working with. And I don't think anyone is, probably one of the reasons you find it difficult, no one has expressed this before. I don't know where you could go to get this except for here. And the other thing is that it applies both personalistically and collectively. That as a individual self change, that is a drop in the ocean of the collective self's change. And vice versa, when you have been the object of evil and you are reflecting back to, maybe that perpetrator is not going to respond, but to the universe, whatever that is going to then put a drop in yourself and transforming it. I think this is also the difficult thing to grasp. This, I guess you'd have to say, this synchronistic shift between the personal and the collective self, which admittedly, these are all hypotheses. But as far as I can see, there's some truth to it. And again, back to Pauli, why it's so important, because he started off asking, what about the evil in the bombs? And sure enough, look what comes up. But he, in the one hand, he asks the question. On the other hand, he excuses himself from the answer by saying God is not, cannot possibly be conscious. Meaning that the destructive side of the God image will always have its way. And Jung is saying, no, it won't always have its way if we can see it. Okay. So we got the light and dark in Christ. That's okay, right? Interesting point now on 97. Well, hopefully, is this making sense to everybody? Everybody comfortable? Okay, because it's crucial. I think another very important sentence on 97, the second paragraph. Seen from this standpoint, Polly's faith from a religious view is wholly significant. In May 1929, he left the Roman Catholic Church. And now in the nuclear age, he had, should be the feeling that he also had to leave physics. Not only the church, but also physics became for him a place forsaken by God. I mention that because you will hear talk about unifying science and religion. But if we take Pauli as our paradigm, they both have to be left before they can be synthesized. I think it's a very big point. So uniting science as it is and religion as it is not going to happen. Because not only do we have to go through a dark night of the soul with respect to religion, but with respect to science, and no longer believe in either, and be disgusted with both.
How would you ever leave science, do you think? I mean, in what sense? Leave it in what sense?
Well, I think science has become the new religion. It's what's believed in.
So you're not talking about a physical rejection of everything that science has brought?
No, but about believing that our world's getting better because we are...
A belief in science as a savior.
As a savior. This is the way to a better life.
I would guess that Newton was smart enough to know that he was up at the wall, and he knew that science had its limitations. So when you're that smart, you know.
Yeah, but he was
where the bones are buried.
He was an alchemist.
Well, I'm saying that's why he went to alchemy, I guess, is because he knew that science didn't answer all his questions.
Right.
And I'm sure that Pauli was already at that wall also.
He was, absolutely, but he couldn't cross it.
Knowing that science didn't have all the answers.
Right. See, if he, I bet he would sit here and intellectually say that. But if we then said, so Pauli, why aren't you lecturing on your Chinese contents on the stranger? The fact is he got his self-esteem from his place in physics. And that's what had to be sacrificed. That worldview, everything it produces, can no longer be the basis of our self-understanding. Again, it's not to say to get rid of it, but to allow it and religion to transform. Let's have a break.
Okay.
Yes?
Quick. Here's something. They both have to go through the dark night.
Right.
Before they could be transformed.
Right.
And then before there's any hope of uniting.
Right.
Does that mean that both, if I'm making this, does that mean that both Christ, the light side of Christ, and the dark side, Satan, would have to both go through their dark night of the soul?
That'd be another way to put it.
It's hard to, it's hard for me to imagine what the dark night of the soul would be for a Satan.
Global warming, maybe?
Yeah.
Well, if Satan is the god of science, global warming could smack down that god, because we don't know what to do.
Another way it might be to put it, it's power, that science really is Western power. Our ability to manipulate and affect change in the world, build highways, hospitals, even though the uses may be good, they're still power.
But it doesn't have to be. This is the way it often goes, and it's interesting that the American nuclear group did not want Pauli to be a part of the bomb making, because they thought he'd keep that purity and stay away from the power thing. But it tends to creep in, but it doesn't have to in science. Science could be ethical too.
I agree. And the way it will get that way is if it goes through a dark night of the soul too.
Yeah.
I mean, we're not saying get rid of science. We're saying that we need a new attitude towards it, mm-hmm. and that attitude will come not by accepting it the way it is and religion the way it is and finding how they belong together or there's a secret union, because that will never happen. Yeah. But a distrust must emerge for both of them, and they both of them can come back on a different level. Time for a break. Take a break! Take a break! I know it's interesting, but take a break!
Shut up!
Shut up and sing! Can't wait to see the news.
That's a perfect moment to say, hold that thought!
Hold that thought!
Hold that mirror up and keep it down.